Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of December. In so many ways, eyes are on Illinois this week, and we're going to be looking at a story that has really received a great deal of national attention since last week. The nation's grim economy has a rallying point. Employees at a window and door factory that went out of business took over the building last week, and it's become a symbol, really, of the angst of the ordinary worker in America at this time in history. The Republic Windows and Doors factory closed abruptly last week after the Bank of America canceled the company's financing. Over 200 of the laid-off workers have taken turns occupying the factory, declaring that they will not leave until they have received assurances that they'll receive severance and also accrued vacation pay. There is news today from Bloomberg that Republic Windows and Doors workers did receive a victory when Bank of America offered loans to the firm to resolve a pay dispute. Bank of America said in a statement that it was prepared to provide a limited amount of additional loans to Republic and expressed concern over Republic's failure to pay their employees the employee claims to which they are legally entitled. There was to be a rally today at noon at the Bank of America building in downtown Chicago. We'll talk about whether or not that will be going on and what this sit-in means, and whether or not it's the beginning of a number of such sit-ins as people lose jobs during this rough economy all over the country. And we'll look at the issue of fairness as well. So we have a lot on the plate. I think we're going to be jammed with phone calls this hour. Our guest I happen to see on the nightly news, NBC, a couple nights ago, and thought he would be a great guest for our show, and Rhonda booked him, and here he is. Professor Bob Bruno is our guest. Professor Bob Bruno is associate professor at the School of Labor and Employment Relations and co-director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He says he became a professor because he believed it was the best way for him to act on behalf of working class men and women. His school has a longstanding and significant commitment to labor studies and the institutions that support collective bargaining. He has done research on working class and union studies issues and is the author of a couple books, including Reforming the Chicago Teamsters, The Local 705 Story, and Steelworker Alley, How Class Works in Youngstown. And he's published many articles as well. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you want to join us by email today, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We got a bad phone line here. Professor Bruno? Yeah, we'll try and hello? Yeah, we've got some kind of severe feedback, so we will try and reach him again. Our number two of our program today, this is one fascinating book, Matthew Alexander. This is a pseudonym, and when I say the title of the book, I will explain why it's a pseudonym. Is the author of How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains Not Brutality to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. Matthew Alexander was one of those interrogators, and he will be joining us. He served for 14 years in the U.S. Air Force and has conducted more than 300 interrogations and supervised more than 1,000. He was awarded the Bronze Star for his achievements in Iraq, and he will be joining us hour number two. Professor Bob Bruno, there we go. We're okay. Now, hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
All news is coming out of Illinois these days, isn't it?
Woo! Yeah, I don't know if this is the case with all news is good news, however.
Yeah, exactly. We'll talk about Blagojevich a little bit later. Do you know what the latest, are the workers still at the Republic Windows and Doors factory with the news from Bank of America? Is there still a rally planned for today?
Most certainly, yeah. The rally is still planned. There's still a vigil and a occupation at the facility. The union came forward yesterday and pointed out that the erroneous information that the bank had agreed to some sort of line of credit to help make some nominal payments, in fact, was not true, and it hadn't been verified, and there had not been a deal worked out. So, in fact, they're still negotiating, but still going forward with a big rally planned on LaSalle Street in the financial district at Bank of America, along with some other demonstrations that are going to happen at different Bank of America sites around the country.
So this report that's coming out of Bloomberg today is not substantiated, that they said that they were prepared to provide a limited amount of additional loans?
Well, the workers feel like they need to get direct verification of that. Apparently, Bank of America claimed it issued a statement to the media, but in fact did not talk to the workers or the union representing the workers. And, of course, the workers don't know where the company fits in on all of that. So they're demanding something more than a press release to Bloomberg and other media.
Give us a background on this. They were fired with 3 days' notice. Is that right?
Yes, sadly, they were. The company gave notice to roughly 250, 260 workers on a Tuesday that they would be completely shuttering their facilities at the end of the week on Friday, made some very oblique reference to Bank of America not providing them with the necessary credit line to maintain operations. And when the workers attempted to meet with the company to discuss both the company's legal obligations under federal and state law and to further discuss the handling of workmen of money owed to workers, the company refused to meet, and that's what generated the form of self-help resistance by occupying the plant.
Mm-hmm. And this certainly has received a whole lot of attention. We haven't seen citizens of this nature in a long time, have we?
No, it's extraordinary. This is a local event at a moderate sized facility, but it seems to have captured the imagination and captured the sentiment of working and middle class folks from around the country and generated an enormous amount of national attention. And I think it's because it's a very practical, real world example of what happens when banks simply stop loaning money to private businesses, and when private businesses attempt to seek out the cheapest labor possible, it actually generates unemployment and severe hurt. And so we've got this real practical case that's unfolding, and so many workers have lost jobs recently, and there hasn't been sort of much public attention to the mainstream street costs. We've got an example of a fight back.
Mm-hmm. What are the legal obligations of the company?
The company is obligated under the Federal Warrant Act passed in 1989, which grew out of the severe recessions in the early and mid-80s, where companies closed up shops and did so without any notice, leaving not just workers and their families, but the communities absolutely in shock and no opportunity to respond to it, nor did the public regulatory agencies had any opportunity to intervene. So the law was passed, and it obligated a company that had a minimum of 100 workers who worked more than 20 hours for a prolonged period of time, to give at least 60-day notice from the point at which the company had known that it was going to close down, so that there can be some attempt to intervention and to essentially make whole on any unpaid compensation owed to workers. And the state of Illinois has its own notification act that requires companies actually with 75 employees or more to provide notification. So in this case, the company failed to provide notification, and it's obligated when it does that to make sure that it meets all of its legal obligations for vacation pay, for any time worked in which workers haven't yet been paid, and possibly to pay workers for the remaining 60 days. And if they don't abide by the law, they can be liable not only for the back pay workers alone, but $500 a day accumulated fines.
Mm-hmm. So there will be a legal course for all of this.
There might very well be. If some settlement can't be worked out between Bank of America and the company, the next step, of course, would be to go into court and to sue for damages and for unclaimed payment.
Mm-hmm. And what kinds of comments? I haven't heard very many comments from Republic Windows. What's the management saying about this?
It's very curious. The company's not saying much at all. I mean, this is it appears to be a company that really wanted to take this action in the dead of night, undercover, if you will. They've not said anything at all. There have been no efforts to communicate with the union representing the workers. There's been no public statements. It's rather quite curious because the firm has been here for some time and it's been a profitable firm, but they have remained very quiet, only to give the very oblique statement last week that this is a product of their inability to secure additional financing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And then we got the whole Bank of America situation here, and they've received, you know, a whole lot of money. They're involved in this
Yeah, they're part of that $700 billion.
Billion. I wanted to say million, and I realized, no, it's not. It's billion, right.
Right, right. And they got $15 billion initially, and they've secured, and they're expecting a second allotment from the Troubled Asset Relief Program, known as TARP, that Congress provided. And one key provision of that bailout was that banks that received government money, taxpayer dollars, were obligated to loan to commercial businesses, to refinance mortgages. But in fact, what we're beginning to find out, and I think the congressional oversight panel that produced a report last week in Congress noted that, in fact, this isn't happening, that mm-hmm. banks are taking this money and not loaning out. And here is seems to be a really, again, a practical example of the consequences of doing that. And Bank of America has, to some degree, kind of washed its hands of it, almost like Pontius Pilate, and said that, you know, it's not up to them make good the wages for the workers, that this is something that the company is obligated to do, and they simply have nothing. They have simply nothing to do with it. But that doesn't seem to be an argument that anybody's accepting.
Well, what are they doing with all their money?
That's a good question. A couple of things the government report identified was that some banks are buying other banks. They're using it as investment money to buy other troubled banks and to grow even larger oligopolistic-sized banks, almost on the level of the late 19th century robber barons. Some of it has gone to still paying dividends. Others are being used for still creative forms of high-risk in investments. But what clearly isn't being done, and it's hard to be absolutely certain who's doing what, because Henry Paulson, the Secretary Treasurer, has simply not made available the names of all the banks that have received money and what they've, you know, essentially what they're doing with all that money. So we're not completely sure, but what we do seem to know is that they're not loaning it to businesses that need it to maintain payroll.
Yeah. Well, that's our money. Somebody's got to look after that, right?
Absolutely. And this is what certainly these workers are saying. You know, they're saying the bank's got a bailout. Workers got sold out. Isn't the purpose of the bailout, the investment of taxpayer dollars to stimulate the economy, isn't it consistent with the new administration's desire to put people back to work? Isn't this what, you know, bipartisanship called for in passing of the bailout provision? And yet it doesn't seem to be happening. And so it raises a real serious question whether this has been money very well truly invested, and it's probably generating some of the rank and file militancy and anger that we see starting to bubble up on the streets of Chicago.
Right. Phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. We have all but one line. All lines but one are filled, but there's one open for you right now. Our guest is Professor Bob Bruno, Associate Professor, School of Labor and Employment Relations, and co-director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And we are talking about the employees who have been conducting a sit-in since last Friday at the window and door factory that went out of business. They gave their employees 3 days' notice. Republic Windows and Doors closed last week after the Bank of America canceled the company's financing. And we're looking at the workers' response and why it's become a symbol of workers being laid off all over the country, the action that they've taken, the dramatic action they've taken, and really forced, I think, people to look at where this bailout money is going and what's fair for workers and what's fair for banks, et cetera, et cetera. It's a big issue and deserves a bit of examination. So we welcome your phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Wednesday, Matthew Alexander will join us. That is a pseudonym. He's the author of How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. All right, let's go to phone calls for Professor Bob Bruno, and we start with Sam from Stockton, Illinois. Hi, Sam.
Hello, Kathleen. I'd like to first say that my heart goes out to those people that have lost their jobs. I'm really, you know, we're all in the same boat together, really, here in America, and I'm just really concerned about all that. But I'd like to say, you know, Bank of America is a business, just like Windows and Doors is a business, correct?
Correct.
And when this business was going bad, Bank of America saying, hey, we're not going to loan these people any more money. Now, that's, to me, responsible banking. You know, we're giving all this bailout money to these banks, and we expect them to be responsible for loaning this money out. And now we have a company that is going out of business that a bank is loaning to. That doesn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sam, that you raised a good point, and obviously some real hard decisions have to be made in a market economy like ours. So we need to sort of look at the facts, you know, as they are, situation by situation. Just some additional things that we should say, however, about this particular case. There's no clear evidence, actually, that this company was unprofitable. In fact, it had been profitable and had not reported to be in any real danger. It was not a company that seemed at risk. It has a very strong local and regional market. Second, the company has also it seems as if the current ownership has purchased an alter ego plant in Iowa, a plant that was previously operated by a different employer, and the new operation has been taken over in the name of the wife of the current owner of Republic Door and Window. Now, this suggests certainly that the company is looking perhaps to move its operations, perhaps for rational reasons, but it's also possible that they're interested in moving their operations to Iowa, which is recognized as a state with a very, very low union density. It's actually referred to as a right-to-work state, and the point of that is it's quite possible that the company sees that it can that it can operate its facilities at half the pay rate, at $7, $8 an hour as opposed to $14 an hour. So this isn't necessarily the case of a company in dire straits and a bank that simply said it's painful, but, you know, it's throwing bad money after bad. It looks like a profitable company that feels like it can make even more profits by finding a facility where they can hire workers non-union at half the pay. Now, you know, these are the sort of facts that need to really be explored, but it lends a little bit more complexity to, I think, to just a situation where the company's going out of business and the bank simply can't do anything about it.
And to add another level of complexity, if this is true, my understanding is that this company makes energy-efficient doors and windows, and we've been talking about the new administration about helping those exact kinds of companies as we try to rejuvenate the American economy.
That's correct. Everything that we're hearing out of the president-elect is that, and there seems to be broad bipartisan support for this, that billions of dollars will get poured into energy efficiency. In fact, it's part of the effort to bail out the auto industry. And so there's every reason to believe that businesses with a track record like Republic Window and Door that have been in operations for some time, that have modern equipment, they have trained and skilled workers, that they would be very well situated to take advantage of expanded markets. So contrary, again, to the notion that this is a dying firm, this is a firm that's operating, that's struggling a bit in the short term during a tough economic time, but is probably well situated to be significantly profitable in the near future, and to argue that we have to shut it down when, in fact, there seems to be an investment of capital in opening another plant in Iowa at lower cost suggests that something is truly rotten in Denmark here.
Hmm. Thanks for the call, Sam. Let's go to Patrick from Waukesha next. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, guys. Hi. Thanks for taking my call
here.
I wanted to just make some points that I haven't heard a lot, but I think are going to be coming up more and more. You know, they say that wisdom lives in truth. And so for us to be making some really wise decisions globally and locally, we got to realize that that strong backs and nimble fingers, that's what makes the world go round. Mm-hmm. The real wealth of this world is the people and their time. The concept of money is really just a lot of hooey. It's mm-hmm. people's time. It's what they're going to devote to your corporation, your community, and your family. And I'd really like to see more of the unions, and I am a union member, and I do have a certified wage. Anybody can look up my wage with the state of Wisconsin. I would like to see the unions going more for 6 and 4 hour shifts to maintain the integrity of the workforce. Everybody gets a piece of the pie. And I'd really like to see the workers demand more clarity and certify, salaries for the whole company, have those things all, you know, available to everybody. And to really reprioritize work when it's slow, mm-hmm. it's okay to spend time with your family. It's okay to raise your own children. It's okay to maintain your own house and yard and just to be a good neighbor. So I really think that the people need to realize that their time can be well spent. You don't have to be punching the clock to be a worthwhile citizen.
Well, and you know, that's very well said. And, you know, historically, when the labor movement has operated at its highest moral standard, it has directly equated quality of work life to citizenship, the balance between the community and the family and the workplace. Of course, to do that, one has to sometimes act in a more militant defense of rights to support the right to work. And if you can maintain this operation in Chicago, for example, then you can begin to discuss some of the creative thoughts that the college has suggested, that one could think about a kind of job sharing or a reduction of hours or short-term layoffs in which then people could have some sustenance during some harder times, but yet focus more on some activities that they might not otherwise be able to, and then go back to work full-time when they can do it. And you know, certainly these are skilled workers who've dedicated sometimes 20 years or more to their workplace, which is why they're in this facility, because they care about the work, they care about the plant, and they feel like it embodies their labor, and so it's part of their identity. You know, they're keeping the plant clean, they're shoveling snow. That facility's never been so well taken care of. But first, you've got to keep them there. You know, you've got to keep them there before you can sort of promote creative ways of mixing family and work life.
Thank you, Patrick, very much for the call. I've been struck by what the neighbor's response has been here. Can you talk about how the workers are being taken care of day by day? Food's being brought to them. Toys are being brought to them.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. It's really quite incredible. There has been a real sense of working-class solidarity, if you will, a sense that this happened to you, it could happen to us. We're all in this fight together. Of course, we're encroaching on the holiday season, and that adds a level of emotion and sensitivity to it. But you do. Every day there are vigils being held They're being held predominantly by the Chicago Interfaith Committee for Worker Justice, which is a multi-religious denomination organization that does a lot of outreach work and advocacy on behalf, particularly of low-wage workers. And so they're keeping a constant vigil. There's prayer vigils. There are invitations for people to come out to bring food, to bring donuts, to bring bagels, to come by, to talk, to share stories. There's a actual schedule planned over the next few days for rallies that will happen there, and invitations to either come by with you know, some toy, as you say, for the child of one of the workers, or just for fellowship, to provide a fellowship. And you know, and that's from the street. This is from the community. And by the way, this is not a facility that's tucked into a residential neighborhood. It's a bit out of the way on Goose Island. It's in a commercial district. So you have to make an effort to go there to show your support. You have to, you know, make plans to put on your winter coat and your gloves and sort of truck on over there. And yet they're getting hundreds of people on a daily basis. And they're expecting today at the Bank of America office at LaSalle Street, perhaps 1,000 people or more to essentially close down the financial district. So it's very heartwarming, and it does look like the kind of working class level of consciousness and support that's been generated at other times in American history when economic conditions have really badly deteriorated.
We go next to Pat from Ridgeland. Hi, Pat.
Well, good morning. Hey, I guess is what I'm wondering about. We know that all the bailout money so far in the financial industries went to the biggest insurance company in the world and the four or five biggest banks in the world. And maybe rather than being too big to fail, they're actually too big to sustain. I mean, it looks like they were trying to create a monopoly on the financial industry. And now that that model is in a nosedive and melting down, it all, does it look to anybody else like maybe they're just stealing what they can before the whole thing just collapses?
You know, you can't help. You can't help but be very suspicious and cynical of all of this. And, you know, I certainly hope that there isn't some sort of grand conspiracy or expectation of a crash, and people are looking to just get what they can before they get out. But it's very clear. It's very clear that the financial industry is not thinking of these workers at Republic Door and Window. They're really not thinking of the workers who are being laid off at facilities around the country. They're certainly not thinking about people who can't refinance their mortgages, or those folks who can't get in to first homes. And it's hard to believe that their interests are aligned with what's good for America, because it clearly seems to be, their actions clearly seem to be contrary to building a strong, prosperous, democratic economy in which wealth is distributed in a way that's, you know, predicated on hard work and investments. So, I mean, I understand that level of suspicion, and I have no doubt that the banking interests are not aligned with the workers on the streets of Chicago. And it's going to, and apparently, these group of workers, these largely Hispanic workers in Chicago, are sending a loud message to the nation and to Washington that we'd better start realigning these interests, or there could be a higher level of militance and resistance that begins to develop.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. I was interested in this comment from the vice president of the union local representing the workers, Melvin Macklin, who said that he was surprised that a lot of the workers were surprised by the support they've generated. His comment was this: we never expected this. We expected to go to jail. Why didn't they?
Why didn't they go to jail?
Yeah.
And this is what workers would expect. I mean, historically, you know, frankly, labor resistance in the United States is probably the most violent and conflictual of any industrial nation's history. Strikes tend to last longer. There's been more use of police and military. There have been more workers arrested and killed. Not for a long time, but clearly that is the history. And this is, in fact, an act of trespassing. I mean, it is against the law to do what they're doing. I think it is extraordinary why they haven't gotten arrested. arrested. One has to do with the fact that to arrest him, you really do have to work your way through a gauntlet of workers and working class families that have kept vigil in front of that plant. So you're going to have to sort of deal with the interaction of pushing around hardworking citizens. Secondly, they're not acting violently. This is very peaceful.
Right. They're shoveling the snow.
They're keeping the place clean.
Yeah.
Third, you know, they haven't stopped production. It's not like the company is trying to make money at this facility. The company's abandoning it. And so they're not, you know, they're not keeping the plant from operating. In fact, they're sending just the opposite message. They're saying, we want to keep these jobs here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is also a community that has a large working class ethnic a mixture. It's got a great history of ethnic and neighborhoods, and it's a strong union town. And it's happening at a time when the nation and I think working people are deeply fearful of what's going to happen. And to some degree, what they see happening here in Chicago is a rallying cry, and everybody's now invested. It's really a national story now.
Right.
And when you put it in that context, you know, then it isn't surprising when you get the chief of police in Chicago saying, you know, I don't see any laws being broken here. and I don't think the company's ordering anything to happen, because you certainly don't want the public relations that are involved in that. And both the mayor, strongly supported by working class votes, and even our now arrested and soon to be indicted governor, frankly, came right out and said, "I'll put all the authority that you know that I still have, you know, at the support at the behest of these workers." So I don't know how long they can stay there without being arrested, but right now there doesn't seem to be any real. Interest in pulling these people out of the handcuffs.
I know on Monday of this week, Blagojevich said that he had ordered all state agencies to stop doing business with Bank of America to pressure the bank into using federal bailout money to help the laid-off workers. Where does that stand right now, considering what happened with him yesterday?
Yeah, right. Well, unfortunately, fortunately, his unfortunate legal problems really in no way jeopardize the state and his authority to take that action. And he still has absolutely full authority to oversee the state administration, and that would include taking steps to pull business out of Bank of America. There has been a request made to the state's attorney general to also and the State Department of Labor to investigate labor law violations at the company, and 15 aldermen in the city of Chicago have proposed legislation that would dramatically restrict Bank of America's financial opportunities in the city. And all these things are going forward and are probably we'll probably hang out there until there's some sense of a resolution, you know, brought about by the parties.
More phone calls in a moment. Thanks very much, Pat, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest this hour is Professor Bob Bruno, Associate Professor, School of Labor and Employment Relations, and co-director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's written several books, has taught many industrial relations courses to trade union members working in public, private, and professional occupations. He hosts a cable show called Illinois Labor Works on Chicago Public Access Channel and is a frequent commentator on regional national media. Is a member of the University Association of Labor Educators, director of the Chicago Chapter of Labor and Employment Relations Association, and co-chair of the Chicago Center for Working Class Studies. We're talking this hour about a story that has received significant national attention, and that's the closing of Republic Windows and Doors factory, giving workers 3 days' notice. The workers, and this was after Bank of America canceled the company's financing. It's a more complicated story than that, but it's received so much attention because the workers have conducted a sit-in. They're taking care of the plant. They want severance pay, they want their vacation pay, but more than that, they'd like to see the company keep going. So we're talking about all of this, this hour of the program with our guest. One line is open if you'd like to join us. And we have that email address, too, and that's talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to your phone calls now, and Marion from Madison is next. Hi, Marion.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I had two things I'd like your guest to comment on. One is what I call the rule of 40, and there was a guest on probably 10 or 15 years ago on public radio that talked about that. And the other is the almost total erosion of the United States manufacturing base. The rule of 40 is that the highest paid person in a corporation should not be making more than 40 times the lowest paid person in terms of hourly wage. And then the erosion of the manufacturing base, that started probably back in 1980 when we were shipping jobs all over the country. We don't make anything anymore, hardly. And so how can we add any value to that?
You know, great, some great thoughts and comments to react to. First on the rule of 40, boy, you know, if we had, if the rule of 40 were operative today, we would certainly be looking at a much more egalitarian society. The current spread between the CEO and not the lowest paid, but the average production worker in the United States is not 40 times, but it's 411 times.
Oh my.
And it is the largest inequality in the world, but certainly when you compare other industrialized democratic nations, it is considerably by multitudes larger than what we see in Europe or in Southeast Asia. So the last 20 years has seen an incredible growth in the spread between average worker and CEO pay, and that's certainly, you know, part of the story that's unfolded here in Chicago. Manufacturing losses, it turns out, has actually been happening for a bit longer than the 1980s. That we began to lose manufacturing in the United States actually in the 1950s. And what is just terribly painful is that it's been a bipartisan effort. In other words, both Republican and Democratic administrations in Washington have made very little effort to protect American manufacturing, to invest in American manufacturing. They have regularly exposed it to a jungle-like international or global market upon which workers in this country are making a middle-class wage with certain benefits for retirement and to protect healthcare have to compete in an open market against workers who are working for a fraction of that with very little sort of a long-term security. And as a result, the manufacturing base in this country has significantly shrunk. So it's a product of policy. It's a product of law. It's a product of decisions that have been made in Washington and clearly, until there is an acknowledgement that the United States needs an industrial policy, that it actually needs to sit down with all the stakeholders and think about a way to reinvest into its manufacturing. Because, in fact, we still do manufacture in this country. We still make cars. We still generate steel. We still do make things. It's just that it's now a much smaller share of the market, and clearly technology has reduced the amount of workers that you would need in particular industries, except that new industries have called for, with the right levels of education and investment, would call for increased levels of employment. So it's a question of public policy. It's a question of changing the laws to actually reinvest in manufacturing. And absolutely, no nation has ever maintained its economic security, its military dominance, and I would go further even to argue its democratic citizenship, unless it has a well-protected and vibrant manufacturing base.
And thank you so much for your call, Marion. We go to Greg from Fond du Lac. Hi, Greg.
Morning, Kathleen, and good morning to the professor. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning.
I was wondering, Professor, do you know who the law firm is that represents Republic Windows?
No, that's a good question. I do not, and I've not seen any reference to that law firm. Very likely, there is one that's advising them, and I would have expected that the union representing the workers, the United Electrical Workers, would certainly be investigating who they are. Maybe you know. You have any idea?
No, but as you know, C.P.R. Shaw is out of Chicago, and they're notorious for union busting. And you brought up the point earlier about the Alter Ego plant in Iowa, and that would just fit right into their overall strategy.
Yeah, there are a number of, boy, the caller very astutely acknowledges that there are some law firms, and it isn't true of all the lawyers in those particular law firms, and it isn't true of all the things that the law firm does, but Seaforth and Shaw here in Chicago, and there are other law firms like Jackson Lewis that operate in Chicago, do have a nasty reputation for union avoidance and for union breaking, if you will. So I'm sure there is some pretty deep and extensive research being done now to look for those sorts of connections. And the idea of shutting a plant down here overnight and then opening an alter ego facility, non-union, in another state,
right,
is sort of right out of the playbook. It's sort of a classic union avoidance, union breaking playbook. And so that's a very astute point made by the caller.
Thank you, Greg, very much for the call. Do you know who came up with this idea? Do you know the background of this? Who decided, well, let's just stay in the plant?
You know, you'd like to think that there was some, you know, visionary people who'd been sort of thinking it all out for months and weighed all the pros and cons. And in this case, there was apparently some discussion. As soon as the workers were notified, of course, they were in shock, but they quickly gathered themselves. Their union jumped right in, a very, very responsive, democratically run union here in Chicago. They immediately interacted with the rank and file, held some sit-down meetings with the entire workforce, and talked about some possible options. And there was discussion, and this was one of the things on the table. Well, maybe, we should simply occupy the facility. After all, we made the windows, we made the doors, we haven't gotten our pay. The company's abandoning the property, abandoning us, so in lieu of wages, we're entitled to this property. And, you know, what do you think? Do you think we'll get arrested? How do you think the community will react? So they did a little bit of an analysis of where they were, and it was one of a number of options, but it wasn't absolutely certain that this would be the step that they would take. We'll contact the company and see if the company is going to do the right thing. And the plans to occupy kind of went, you know, back and forth. We're on, we're off, we're on, we're off. But ultimately, there was a near unanimous response from the rank and file that, and I think this was the key point, we've got nothing else to lose. And I want all the listeners to understand that if you came to Chicago and you went to this facility, you would, of course, be welcome with open arms. You can't get in beyond the lobby because the workers are protecting the facility. They're not going to let strangers get beyond the lobby. But there isn't five people occupying the plant. There's not 10. There's not 20. They're around the clock, multiple shifts, and over 200 workers have taken their turn occupying the plant. It's their home.
It's their home. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Ralph from Green Bay next. Hi, Ralph.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just curious. You know, it seems like just based on a rule of law, if you've got a contract with the union and you, part of that contract is for to pay severance and back pay or whatever the contract is, and the company does not fulfill its part of the contract, then they should be charged with that. I mean, that should be considered a crime, and they either pay up or go to jail. So, you know, as far as Bank of America is concerned, I think, first of all, you go to the company and say, hey, you owe this money. You're in contempt if you don't pay it. As far as they're moving to Iowa, I don't think you can really stop them from moving to Iowa. But you should be required to make good on whatever your agreement was with the union.
You know, it sounds like our caller's dog is in absolute solidarity. and animals, by the way, seem to be welcome on the at the vigils also. Yeah, I mean, the WARN Act does apply penalties. It does hold the company responsible for making payment, perhaps, for every day in which they violated wages, and a fine for every day the act is violated. And under the union contract, if the company has violated the contract under national labor law, the union can go into a district court and sue for damages. So there really are some legal costs. Unfortunately, what a lot of businesses have concluded is that, you know, this is a slow grinding process. The workers don't have a lot of staying power. They're desperate. The union doesn't have significant resources, and so we can just sort of wait them out. And even if we end up making some sort of legal payment somewhere down the road, it's just the cost of doing business. And if we can get out of Chicago and go to Iowa and pay the workers half the price that we pay them and not pay them any health care, well, then it looks like a rational business move on our part. And sadly, in the United States, unlike a lot of other industrialized nations, labor laws are not very protective. They're not very strong in the United States. So these workers are acting, you know, fairly courageously to enforce a mildly protective law. And so there is a business inducement for employers who want to act unlawfully. And that's a sad state. That's a sad statement about American democracy.
Do you foresee a change in that, Professor Bruno, with labor laws becoming stronger?
There is every expectation that the Obama administration and an expanded the Democratic majority in Congress, almost to the person, elected with working class votes and a significant amount of support from organized labor, that the administration and Congress will pass a major piece of labor law reform known as the Employee Free Choice Act, which in its simplicity will simply remove the employer from the decision as to whether workers want or do not want a union. That hasn't been the case for the last 50 or more years. And where employers are removed from that decision, workers express significant support to unionize. And that labor law also has some other very important pieces to it. If it gets passed either in the first 100 days or happens in the first term, estimates are that we will see a few additional million workers added to the unionization column, and that should have a significant multiplier effect on essentially how workers are treated in workplaces all over America. So the labor movement is expecting some significant positive, if you will, reward for its effort here in November.
Ralph, thanks for the call. Craig from Onalaska, hi.
Good morning. The guest speaker made the comment that the company might want to move to Iowa to half their salary costs and do away with health care. So my question is, has anyone ever done a study showing what it costs the average American when they, for example, buy a new car? They pay a huge amount for GM's health care costs. Mm-hmm. Or if a local plumber comes and has health care through his employer, we have to pay that. Mm-hmm. If you did away with all that and just paid health care out of income taxes, would we be money ahead as far as the average American?
You know, there are lots of ways to sort of respond and think about and discuss the this very interesting point that the caller makes. But what I think it's really sort of getting to is that if, in fact, we moved away from a private market insurance-based insurance system, an employer-based system, and we went to a Canadian or a European government-provided single-payer plan, would we lower health care costs? Would the burden on the worker and the employer go down? And by absolutely every independent analysis that has been done, if you were to remove the health care cost from the relationship. The benefits to the consumer, to the worker, to the employer, and to the taxpayer would be significant. So I don't actually have dollar figures in front of you. There are a number of organizations who are advocating for this sort of government reform of health care. But where, in fact, these plans operate in many other countries, there's a distinct competitive advantage for those countries. Because that health care cost is simply not a product of the labor management relation, and it isn't, if you will, sort of built in to the price of the good, because it's been socialized, it's been nationalized, it's been allotted for across the entire citizenship, and it's paid through as a product of tax investment. So the United States would be far better off, consumers, all of us would be far better off if we walked away from an employer-based private market insurance system and went to some Canadian-type single-payer plan.
Professor Bob Bruno, thank you so much for being with us. We'll follow today's developments closely, and thank you so much for your time today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this hour, Professor Bob Bruno. He's Associate Professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations and Co-Director of the Labor Education Program at the University of Illinois, based in Chicago, and has been following this story, obviously, pretty closely and commenting on it for national news outlets. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll probably be doing another show on this and expanding it somewhat down the road. Well, that's it for this hour. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Stay tuned. We'll be with you again for another hour in just a moment here on the Ideas Network.